I don't really believe in coincidences. And so I think this is the talk that was supposed to be recorded, not the talk that I gave last week. And I think it has to do with a practice discussion I had with someone a couple of days after last week's talk. And it's all I can do. I mean, I've told this discussion I've had with so many people because I don't know a better example of the second noble truth ever. I mean, I've never even had one in my own practice that was so distinct and so clear. So I think that's the example that we need to hear. And having it recorded so anyone can hear this makes it all the more important. So I really think that's why this talk is the talk that's supposed to be recorded, so we can all hear that example. But I'm not going to tell you about the example yet. I want to first go back and talk a little bit about this second noble truth, because that's the truth we're coming into. We spent a month with Dukkha, and now we are coming into a discussion for a month on the cause of Dukkha. And the cause, just to put it up front here, the cause is considered to be desire, this craving that we have as human beings for sensual pleasure, for becoming and for not becoming. And so this first couple of weeks, I'm not talking about the actual desires. We're going to talk about those in the next 2 weeks. But the first 2 weeks, I just wanted to talk about this idea of craving, this cause, just the idea or the nature of how we could think of the second noble truth as cause. And it is such a subtle practicing place to be with this idea of cause and the origin of dukkha, that spending more time on that first before you delve into the actual desires seems important to me, that we separate this out. And so last week I looked up these words, and I just want to repeat the definitions of what these words are in connection with this idea of the cause of dukkha, the cause of our suffering. So I looked up the word cause, and in Webster it says something or someone that produces an effect or result or condition, makes something happen. It's the reason for doing or feeling something. And so whenever I hear that, just in the nature of the way English is, it's like there's a fault for my suffering. There's a reason, a cause, a fault for my suffering. So I looked up the word fault, and it says, a Webster, it's a bad quality or a weakness in one's character. Very significant, a problem. Not the very significant, that was my part. A problem or a bad part that prevents something from being perfect, a flaw or defect, the reason for the problem, mistake, or bad situation. So when we think about the second noble truth and we're using English words, it's important to understand that English impulse to think of the second noble truth as the bad reason I'm having all these problems, the fault of all this mess that I'm having. It's some flaw with me, some character mistake, something I need to fix to make it more perfect in order for me not to have dukkha. But that is not the second noble truth. I'm just going to flat out say that. That is just not the pointing or the leaning into the second noble truth. So I looked up some other words like noble. Why would it be called a noble truth? So noble is having or showing or coming from personal qualities that people admire. So it's the qualities within us that people admire, such as honesty, generosity, and courage. It's relating to or belonging to the highest social class. We have this, there's a dignity and nobility that comes with the second noble truth. And the word truth is the real facts about something, the things that are true. And just to bring a little bit of continuity, because some places the second noble truth is considered the origin of suffering, not necessarily using the word cause of such suffering. So the origin, I looked up that word, and it is the point or place where something begins. It's the point or place where something begins or is created. The source or the cause of something. Now that makes a little bit more sense to me when I think of practice. I just never have this connection that practice is related to anything that says I'm bad, something's wrong, I need to fix something. Practice always points to a much more higher nobility, a higher resonance, and I have to just look for that higher resonance so I can see it. So I was sharing last week that I came into the practice thinking something's wrong. And this is why I'm taking the step back to talk about this so we can begin to see how much wisdom was in this practitioner's example. But when I first came into the practice, my initial thoughts were, I've got all this bad stuff happening to me, all this stuff that's going wrong, so I need to go into this practice so it can fix me and make it better, make me more perfect, take away some of the flaws and the difficulties, the mess, what it is. But if you think about just what the actual truth says, it just says, there are just two sentences. The first truth says, there is dukkha. That's it. Not a lot of fluff about that. There is suffering. The second truth is, there is a cause or there is an origin of suffering. But nowhere in the readings or writings about dukkha does anyone say getting laid off is a cause of dukkha. Having bad health is a cause of dukkha. There is no pointing to a particular condition. And the reason why that's important is because we all would think that someone should suffer if they got laid off, that there would be some suffering there, that if somebody's found out they had some, you know, terminal illness or some chronic illness, that there would be this cause for suffering. It would make sense. Something's wrong. That's why I'm suffering. But that's not the pointing. There is no conditioning. There's something else in relation to suffering that is not connected to a conditioning, a bad situation, something has gone wrong. In fact, one way to begin to see that it's not related to a bad circumstance is because dukkha is inherent in good stuff. So you can be having a great time and dukkha still exists there. It is not in the so-called circumstances that we think of what it is. So it has to be something other than whether or not we have a bad circumstance. Because everybody in this room would say, yeah, that's a bad circumstance. You know, my car broke down on the freeway. Oh yeah, that's suffering. I could believe that. Everybody would say that. But that isn't necessarily what this second noble truth is pointing to. It's a little bit more subtle than that. So then I thought, and I talked about last week about this idea that I thought, okay, the reason why I'm suffering is because I just can't accept the bad stuff that happens to me. So if I could just lean in and accept it, just be okay with it. I used the example of, you know, my son and I being in deep snow, and I hate the snow, and his idea of how I would not suffer being in all this snow is to just be one with the snow. But that is not possible, to be with difficulties when you don't like it. That's inherent in the problem. Sometimes the hardest thing I have with insight communities, the hardest edge for me, going on retreats, just being in the sanghas and these larger communities, is what feels like an overwhelming sadness. We kind of walk around like we got the weight of the world on our shoulders. We're walking slow, heads are down. It just looks so sad, so heavy, so burdensome. But the practice actually isn't like that for me. It's much more uplifting. It's much more joyous. It's much more energized. So I was telling someone that really all my practice is about containing energy. Because here I am, this extrovert with big energy in a world full of introverts with small energy. It is the second noble truth. It's so difficult. So I always thought, oh, I just got to accept it, just be with it, just settle down. Try to be more quiet. Try to be more softer. Try to be more, you know, contained. Not quite so loud and big. But I cannot. I cannot do that. And so if I just were to accept that this big energy that I have and being an extrovert and loud is somehow or another a character flaw to my practice, then I am forever like behind the eight ball trying to fix myself. Can you see that? That's what we do. We are forever trying to fix ourselves so we can be the way the mind has told us we are supposed to be. That's the perfect way to be. That's what we're always trying to lean in to fix. So in Ajahn Sumedho's book, he wrote a book called The Four Noble Truths. It's probably the best book I've ever read on the Four Noble Truths. Ajahn Sumedho's like a great Western Thai monk. He sat with suffering for a long, long, I think he's been like a monk for 50 years or something like that. So this all this time sitting with the Four Noble Truths. And he said that the second noble truth is not about getting rid of desire, not about getting rid of the craving. So let me see if I can put this in perspective. The cause of suffering, the origin of suffering, is desire, the wanting, some sensual pleasure, some becoming or not becoming. But the practice with this second noble truth is to stay with that wanting. So the actual word of it is called tanha, T-A-N-H-A, tanha. And it's It is, like translated in English as desire or attachment to the wanting. But the word, I guess in Pali, means more like a hunger or a thirst or a longing. So there's this energetic pull towards something. And we, as practitioners, want to stay in that energetic pull, just stay right there, in the wanting, in the hunger, in the thirst. Not from a place of misery, like, oh, but from this place of interest, of excitement, of wanting to see, admiration. Big energy, it's a bigger energy that we want to begin to look at something that is subtly telling us something's wrong. Just make sure I haven't. All right. One habit that we have is that if we feel that wanting and we feel that hunger, that thirst for something, that kind of begging energy to get something our way or to have something be a certain way or needing to be happy, needing to have something, that energy, as soon as we feel it, we let go. We relax, like, okay, I'm just going to let go and be with this. Let it be all right. It's as if I'm no longer suffering because I stopped desiring. I stopped wanting. I stopped longing. I let go of that hunger. I'm a good practitioner. I've let it go. And when we let it go, it creates in our minds this idea that the end of suffering comes from the letting go of this craving, letting it go. There is a release that's going to happen, but we're going to talk about that a different way when we get to the fourth noble truth. But the fourth noble truth, just so we know, is the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path is what leads to the end of suffering. Not the second noble truth leads to the end of suffering. The second noble truth is a subtle place to see the origin of suffering, not to let it go. We have to wait a little bit before we let it go. So I think this example I'm about to share with you is quintessential what it is that we're trying to do. I'm going to give you a little history first. This practitioner has a chronic illness, and it is not a joke. It is serious illness. So too much, if she does too much working, even around her house, she can trigger her heart to weaken, and she has to go to the emergency room. If she eats something that she shouldn't eat, she can trigger an episode. She has to go to the hospital. It's just this, if she does too much or breathes in something, it triggers this episode, she has to go to hospital, and she can die. So this is serious. But you know, she's been living with it for a while, she practices with it, she's a longtime practitioner, so she's used to it. So one day she goes to some store and she buys this bread, and she got home, and it's gluten-free. She checked it, you know, this is the bread I can eat, it's gluten-free. And so she took a bite. It's the first time she had ever eaten this bread. She took a bite of it, and it was so good. I'm embellishing here, but it was so good, she said, that she ate four pieces And then shortly thereafter, she has an episode. She has to get to the emergency room. And she was there for a good 12 hours, trying to help her get back stable again. So she's practicing, trying to stay present, trying to be okay, because she can lose a lot of, you know, when you're in a state like this, all of a sudden you lose your mental faculties and get caught in a lot of confusion. So she's trying to practice so she stays alert, stays present, everything's okay. They finally get her back stable, and the doctor's going to give her some prescriptions. And she said, no, I don't need it. I got a prescription. I can pick it up tomorrow. It's already at the pharmacist. So they say, okay. She leaves, goes home. So the next morning, she gets up. She calls the pharmacist to get her prescription. And they're like, we don't have any prescription for you. And she's like, oh, no, you got prescription for me. She's like, no, we don't have any. So there's this huge amount of tension that begins to swell because she needs these prescriptions. And she's having all this like anger, and she's trying not to yell at the people on the phone. That's what she wants to do, but she's trying not to yell. Do you guys hear that sound, or am I crazy? Okay, just checking. Make sure. Make sure that there's somebody else that hears that. So she starts doing walking meditation to kind of help her steady herself in between these calls with the doctors and the pharmacist to try to get her medication together. And she's trying to be steady. So then she goes over to this bread, and she's like, what is it about this bread that's caused all of this stuff, right? 12 hours in the emergency room, finally get home, big drama all morning with the pharmacist. What is it with this bread? So she was just gonna toss it in the compost, and she decided to give it a feel, right? What is it? And she noticed that the texture of the bread was perfect. It had the right kind of chewiness and the right kind of, you know, firmness about it. It smelt perfect the way bread is supposed to smell. It looked like this is good bread. And even as she was holding this bread, looking at it, her mind is telling her, this is perfect bread. This is good. This is what we live for. This bread right here. You should have a piece. So she's holding a mind that is telling her, this is good. You should have this. And she is fully aware that this bread is dangerous. It is not okay, and we need to put it in the compost. She's got to hold both of these things simultaneous. But the big understanding that she realizes is that the bread is neutral. That the bread is just some bread sitting here. That bread is not dangerous. I didn't tell her this, but, you know, I kind of wanted to know what was that bread. Because I don't have a problem eating bread. I mean, I'm looking for a good gluten-free bread, so. But she can't eat this bread. So it's important to see that the bread is neutral. It's just bread. To her mind, it is the best ever. Feel free. Eat as much as you want. But in reality, she cannot. So there is this tension that lies in this moment. What we try to do is, oh my God, I can't eat that bread. We take the whole thing, throw it in the trash. I wasted my money. I'm not going to have anything to do with that bread anymore, ever. just not going to ever do anything with it. If I go into the store and I keep getting some yearning to want to go get the bread, we don't even go to that store anymore. So I don't see that bread anymore. But can you see how that just running away, that is the almost like the aesthetic way of practice, like deny, 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 don't even go around it, close yourself off from it, I'm not going to have anything to do with that. And that is how I'm going to end suffering. But it doesn't really work like that, because your mind is always going to want that bread, whether you see it or not. It's always going to think about that bread. Or on the other hand, we can indulge a little bit, right? We just tell ourselves, I'll just get a couple of pieces, just a piece. I'll keep it. It's okay. I can handle it. I'm going to figure out a way to work with it so I can indulge this kind of wanting. And we do that. We indulge into it. But I think the middle way of practice is to see the neutrality of the bread, to begin to see how the mind is telling us what something is, good or bad. The life is neutral. Mind is telling us good or bad. And we have to look at that against reality. Is it good or bad in this moment with me, my reality? And the only way to do that is to stay in the tension of the hunger, of the wanting or the not wanting. Can you see that? I mean, I thought that was the best example of the importance of the Second Noble Truth. Because one of the things she said was that as she was sitting there looking at this bread, she could actually enjoy its smell, its taste. And because she was holding the reality of how dangerous it is for her system, she never had the need to eat it. She could just be with it, knowing that her mind like really enjoys it, and not be with it because it's dangerous. There's no having to do something. There's nothing about a flaw in that. There's no imperfection. There's no wrongness in that situation. It's just what it is. And in order to see that in the various times that happen in our lives, we have to be willing to stay and get interested in or investigate the nature of why the mind is leaning the way it's leaning. Why does it think something is so good and something is so bad? It's not the thing. But we tend to think if the mind says it's bad, it's because that thing is bad. Last example. I went to a long retreat at IMS a few years ago. And it was in the fall, so there's apples galore. And I don't know if you guys have ever been to IMS, but they have some of the best apples. And it's all, there's like the apple yard, all these apple trees all over the place. So they have to get all these apples down and, you know, then they use them. So one time I was doing walking meditation. This was a long retreat. And so this was maybe a weekend. We had gotten most of the apples out of the trees, and they still had other apples growing, because I guess once you pick them, they just keep growing. So I look up at this tree, and I see this apple, and it looked perfect, perfect, red, perfect. I knew it was crunchy. I knew it was good, but I couldn't reach it unless I climbed the tree, and I was tempted. Collect the tree, but I thought, that's okay. There's plenty of apples. I don't have to have that one apple. But every time I walked outside, guess where my eyes immediately went to? I'd look over at the tree. If I haven't been, I mean, that event happened in September of 2013. So in August of 2017, I went to IMS for a retreat. And guess what I looked the entire time? At the tree. It's because the mind gets obsessed over this. It thinks that that was the best apple in the entire world, and I should have got that apple. The fact that I left it there, it keeps wanting to go get it. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for how can you practice with watching the mind's labels on things. When the mind says something is good, how does it say that? Get interested in that. Who said it's good? It's just a thing. If the mind says it's bad, how does it say it's bad? Who says that? Where did that come from? And the subtleness of that hunger, that thirst, that leaning into, it feels like a leaning into, but actually when you're in the sensual pleasure, you're actually also leaning away from non-pleasure, leaning into pleasure, leaning out of non-pleasure. If you want something, you're leaning into that wanting, and you're also leaning into wanting to get rid of something. That's where you want to practice. In the second noble truth, you're not trying to get rid of that feeling. You're not trying to get rid of that tension that you don't want something. Every time you don't want something, stay with that a little bit longer. Stay with that, I don't want this. And try to see if you can investigate why. Where's that coming from? Every time you want something, stay there a little bit longer. Don't even get it. Because if you get what you want, the tension goes away. And you think, oh, I'm not suffering anymore. It's all good. It's going to come right back around. But you don't realize that in that moment that you get it. You think, ah, the end of suffering. The minute you get rid of something, you don't want it, you make it go away. Oh, I can just think about all the times I used intimidation, whatever I needed to get my way, and I got my way. And you know what? I just had to keep doing that. Keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. I have less difficulty now simply because it doesn't matter to me anymore whether I get my way or not. I have my way, I say what I want, but even if I don't get my way, I don't carry that sense of, oh, I gotta have my way. But there was a time when I had to have my way. And I'm getting madder and madder and madder until I get my way. Every time I got my way, I did not realize that I was setting myself up. It's all a trickster. It's all a game. I'm setting myself up for more tension to get my way. More tension to get my way. Gotta get my way. So be careful in this last week here, be careful about this getting what you want, getting rid of what you don't want, before you've had a chance to really feel into that tension. Because that tension is what you want to see. That's what you want to get interested in. Yeah, I think we should leave it there. And let's sit for a few minutes. I like it when we get quiet after a talk. It's like there's all these little words up in the ether that's just kind of scattered about. So we'll see if there's any questions that anybody has. Thank you.
it's sort of normal not to want to be in pain, I think. So I get a little confused, I guess, with the discomfort and looking at the wanting to get rid of something and how to parse that out.
So the question is around the not wanting, and they have a lot of pain, and they don't want it, and so it's just not comfortable wanting it. So how, I guess you're asking me, how do you practice with this not wanting? Is that what you're asking me? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say it like this. If I use the same example from the student that was talking, pain, what we call pain, is the same as the bread. It's actually neutral. It doesn't seem neutral because there's so much not wanting in the mind. Just like the bread doesn't seem neutral, it seems like the bread is good because there's so much wanting in the mind. But sensations, pleasant, unpleasant, they're actually just sensations. They're the same sensations that we all have. And I know this seems a little trite when it comes to somebody that could have chronic pain, like, oh yeah, you don't have chronic pain all the time. Now, I have another friend, maybe I can use her words. And this might help flesh out a little bit more of the neutral. So I have another friend, longtime practitioner, chronic pain. And I always ask her, how do you do that? I don't have chronic pain, but when I have pain, I don't want it, just like you. I just don't want it. How do you practice if you have chronic pain all the time? And what she tells me is, I don't practice to not have chronic pain. Right? So she goes, when I have chronic pain, when I have some painful thing, I try to practice so the pain will go away. That's the whole point is thinking that the pain is the problem. This sensation is the problem, and that has to go away. But then if you live in a situation where it's there all the time, then your practice is more towards how do I hold both the not wanting and the reality that it's here at the same time. And the only way to really hold that is to begin to see the nature of this sensation is neutral. It's just the sensation of it. And that's the way she practices. She practices with, this is pain. So if it's too difficult for her to sit, she doesn't sit. If it's too difficult for her to stand, she doesn't stand. If she doesn't have that, oh, I should be able to stand. Oh, I should be able to sit. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what she tells me. It's like, it's just whatever is arising in that time, that's what she's practicing with, and that's the way it is. But she doesn't try to get rid of the mind's, I don't like this. And some of what we're going to talk about in the next 2 weeks is about this co-arising nature of it, so that we can begin to see that the I don't like this sensation arises at the same time with the sensation. So the expectation that you can somehow or another make your mind like something that it co-arises with I don't like it is crazy making. So we're not trying to make the mind change its mind about something. We are trying to practice with, can I be with the mind's awareness of something, the mind's opinion about something, and reality? Can I be with them both simultaneously? And being with them both simultaneously allows you to see the neutrality of the object itself. You see? But we can't see that neutrality if we're stuck only in the mind's opinion. Good.
I have a little bit of that experience because I have pretty severe arthritis in one hand, and I get these probably once or twice a day we'll get a searing pain in that hand, and it used to really upset me, but now I've like made peace with it in some way.
Yeah.
And it's a searing pain and it hurts, but it's much less than if I stub my toe. If I stub my toe, I am like mad at myself. I have all this mental stuff go on about it.
That's right.
I'm mad at the bed that I hit. I have all of this baggage around it. I haven't like come to peace with. But with my arthritis, it's just like, it's significantly worse than stubbing my toe.
That's right.
But I don't have baggage on it anymore.
That's right. The sting has taken out of it.
Yeah.
It's, so just sort of for the recording, they were using this example of how they have arthritis in one hand, and then they have this searing pain that shows up off and on and throughout the day or once a day or so. And so whenever that pain used to come, it's like, I hate that pain and it's got to go away. But now that you've come to an understanding with the pain, or at least begin to see it as just a thing that comes with having arthritis in a hand, then you've made peace with it. So it still has the searing pain, still unpleasant, but it doesn't have all the stickiness, the baggage that comes with it, which is different when you stub your toe. And it's like a spontaneous, unexpected pain, and then the mind immediately gets upset about it, right? And there's all this, kerfuffle that goes on in the mind about getting mad at the bed, getting mad at you, everything for stubbing our toe. But you can see, if you can see in these two examples that you gave, which are perfect, you can't really use, you can use the hand pain to begin to see the nature of the mind's dislike. But the real work of the Second Noble Truth is to see that hunger, which would be the not wanting, that hunger on the not of wanting sensual pleasure, or in contrast, that not wanting that pain, to see what happens there in that moment. That's the subtleness of the Second Noble Truth. And the more we can begin to work with little things like that, the thing about it is, the stubbing of the toe is something that happens, I don't think anyone in this room would walk around and try to go hit their toes so they can get that practice opportunity. I wouldn't advocate that. So it's one of those kinds of things where much of the, what we would consider the unpleasant aspects of practicing with the Second Noble Truth are going to come like that. In these spontaneous moments in time, we didn't expect it, something happens, I've got this tension, and you want to see if you could hold, especially since we're doing this over the year, can you hold this idea of take a moment, can I look at this? Especially when it's a big tension like that. You're not trying to force the mind to not be mad or not be upset because you stubbed your toe. That is that notion that somehow or another, if I just be one with the toe stubbing, I won't be upset. But that's not true. That's not even reality. So you want to be with that. and also simultaneously kind of see that stubbing toes and things like that just sort of happen. They're like moments in time, and that it doesn't have anything to do with the bed, that the bed's actually neutral. It doesn't even have anything to do with you. It's the nature of walking around furniture and things and, you know, thinking and doing all this other stuff all at the same time. It's in that moment that you could begin to see the wisdom of the Second Noble Truth, because that's how we begin to get less and less and less sticky around reactive things, things that we would normally react with. It just so happens you had the benefit of having a ongoing pain in your hand, so you could see it all the time. But if you remember back, the pain used to come and it was like spontaneous, like a stub toe. And then, but the fact that you just kept working with it is how it is, that it loses its stickiness. That's what we want to begin to do, is not try to get rid of suffering by way of the Second Noble Truth. We're going to talk about getting rid of it later. But right now, we just want to stay with it and stay with that difficulty. So that's a good example of where we're going. But, you know, I also think it's not just that you learn to work with the unpleasantness of the stinginess. There's a whole thing that surrounds us around practice with the Second Noble Truth, that we're going to, with the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eightfold Path. There's a whole way that that Eightfold Path holds us in a moment in time to support our ability to practice. That's why the Eightfold Path is the way to the ending of suffering. Because it's not just the forcing ourselves to let go. It is this meditative quality, this right view, this paying attention to our actions. All of that leads towards a moment when you stub your toe and pay attention to it. That's what you're looking for.
And actually, like what you said, was the pain in my hand gives me the curiosity to look at the pain when I stub my toe.
That's right.
Because I know, I know that did not hurt as much as my hand.
That's right.
In a pain scale, why am I doing this mental thing? So it gives me that curiosity to look.
Yes, that's right. And it is in that second noble, in the fourth noble truth when we talk about it, that we actually have the capacity to look. Because it takes something, if you think about it, when you stub your toe, it takes something to be still for a minute when you really want to cuss out that bed or cuss out whoever put that bed there. We should have put that bed on that side. That's where I wanted the bed to be. That's where we should have put it. Instead of that, it takes something to be willing to take the moment to be still with it and notice what's arising. That's what it was that was so striking about my friend in the bread, that she didn't just go toss it in the compost, like, dang it, I'm never buying that stuff anymore, all the hell I've been through. Instead, she wanted to know, why did I go through all of this over this bread? So that's what we're trying to look for. Why? What is it about this moment that's got the mind all in a tizzy? I mean, I love this part of practice. I can probably get a little bit too joyous on these edges. I know, I have friends that are like, please, Tuareg. Because they'll tell me something like, I had this really terrible thing happen. And I'm like, what? Did you investigate it? What did you see? Let's talk about it. Oh, my God. I know. I have so many friends that are like, don't tell Tuareg because she's just not going to understand. I should be more, you know, like, oh, I feel for you in that moment. But instead, I'm like, let's just dig in, see what happened. What's going on there? And it just comes from seeing so much. It's I probably another way to say this is, we would never ask for some of the difficulties that come to our lives. We would never ask for it. We don't want it, and we would hope it doesn't come. So any difficulty that, to me, comes to me, is the only opportunity that I have to practice with that, because I would never go seek it out. So if some anger comes, I always think to myself, oh my God. I mean, I did so much work with anger that I kind of appreciate it when I have a little anger there, because I have something that I can actually look at, something that's worry or irritation or anything like that. Because no matter how much we can be convinced by our mind that our enlightenment, our liberation is going to come when everything's all smoothed out and everything's going good, then I'm going to be liberated. Not going to happen. We are going to get liberated in the middle of some mess. Somebody sent me a little rap song from this rapper. I cannot believe it. This is pure Dharma. Somebody sent me a little YouTube video of a rap song. And so what this rapper says is that he remembers this particular day because this is the day of his death. And when he dies, he sees himself on the pavement, and he's raised above this pavement. So he's on his way. He says he don't know what to do, but I'm following the light. That's what everybody says, so I'm following the light. So he's following the light, and he's on his way to heaven. And he can't wait to get there. But as he's on his way to heaven, he's getting kind of bored. It's taken a little bit longer to get to heaven than he thought it was going to take. So he's kind of bored. But, you know, he didn't know what to do. He's just kind of going, and then the light splits into two. And when it splits into two, it's two angels. And so the angels tell him, you know, we're here to help you get to God. That's where he's trying to go. Help you get to heaven. Help you get to God's home. We're going to help you. He's like, great. Which one of you? And he said, they're like, well, you got to ask the right question. And if you ask the wrong question, you're going back down. If you ask the right question, you know, one of us is going to tell you the truth. One of us is not. So he's like, okay, whatever. So he's trying to ask all these questions. He's got 30 questions going back and forth, and they're all confused. They don't know the answer. I don't know. It's all this. It's all that. So it's this kind of like, what? He's getting more and more confused. He's not getting any closer to God. He doesn't know what's going on. He said, if he had known that dying was going to be this complicated, he would have stayed living a lot longer. And finally, he says that he just can't take the confusion. So he just turns around and walks away. And when he walked away, he walked into heaven. Can you see that? Just imagine your mind trying to tell you, you should go there. No, you should go there. As if it knows what you're supposed to do. It's only basing every opinion that it makes to you off of something it learned before. So it's saying, go there. No, go there. Do that. No, do this. It's just this constant ordering about. And really, we need to let go of that mind and just find that place here, stillness inside, and go our own way. Because we're trying to get it right. We're trying to figure out how to get it right. And it doesn't work like that. That rightness is already there. We just have to be still and connect to it, find it inside, instead of this constant trying to control and figure out what to do ahead of time. Because it's all unknown. We don't know how to get there. We don't know how to get to heaven. But if we kind of trust inside, then we can find our way. much better than listening to the mind trying to tell us what to do. So in some respects, to me, that's a lot of what the second noble truth is. The second noble truth is getting to know how it is that your mind puts things together. And the way to do that is to stay with some of this, you know, hunger, the wanting, the longing, the wishing. Stay with that energy instead of just getting to the resolve so quick. Man, I am just talking up a storm. I hope it's because you guys don't have any questions, because I'm so excited that this is the tape that we had instead of the last week. I mean, last week was good, but I feel like because of having that discussion with that practitioner, I can articulate it better. I felt like last week I couldn't articulate the subtlety that we're talking about here with this tanha. And probably another way to say it is, nothing about this practice is so easy that all you have to do is let go of craving. It's really not that easy. It's a lot more nuanced than that. So somehow the letting go of craving is going to hurt us. If we just let go, we're not going to learn. You know, we're not going to get that wisdom. And wisdom, as Utejaniya says, it's in the interest in. That's where the wisdom is, when we have the interest in something. And whatever's going on, it's not happening from outside. It's happening inside. So we got to go inside with this interest and investigate what's going on. That's how we're going to begin to see our way to a less dukkha-filled world. So I'll see if there's one more question. If not, then I think we'll leave it there. All right, good. You feel good? I do. Feel steady, so great. So next week, we will talk about the actual desires and how they show up and what to do with them. So who is doing, do we have announcements today? Oh, that's right, we don't have announcements because this is a discussion night. So just check and see if anybody needs a ride home.